Sorry, folks.
Podcast.
Closed. The moose out front should have told you.
Hey, everybody. It's Patrick here. On behalf of Jim, I want to tell you that we are still on summer vacation / recuperation from Grand Rapids Suburbs Fest. And we are re-airing some previous episodes that we recorded and published. This one was first published on July 31st of 2019, and it's episode 654. And it's the first part of a three-part interview with record producer Andy Zaks. He was involved with putting together a box set around the Woodstock concert that has something like 432 tracks, 36 hours of music, and we are discussing it in this episode. If you want to hear the other two, they follow immediately after in numerical order 655 and 656. Happy listening.
Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
it's 3 days of peace and music on the podcast.
Yeah, our permit just came through.
Patrick, of all the interviews we have done, This was one of the most fascinating, would you not say?
Really was. What, by far, I think the one where you're just like, how in the world did 60 minutes just go by?
Yeah, that's
you
right.
know, it was just like I was hanging on every word this guy was saying.
This guy is Andy Zaks, and he's a record producer.
He is.
And we had the great fortune to sit down with him for about an hour recently. And he told us about this mammoth project.
Yeah.
It is the Woodstock 50th anniversary box set that he produced.
Yes.
It is comprehensive. It's the first time they've done a comprehensive set of essentially all the music that was played at Woodstock, right?
It's really unbelievable, Jim. And definitely one of those things where if you look at Andy's resume and his accomplishments, he's done a lot of things, but nothing ever on the scale of a project like this that's so massive. It essentially is recreating in audio, you know, kind of the experience of being there from Friday all the way through Sunday at the original festival. It's a mind-blowing thing. He's got stage announcements, you know, stuff captured in the audience, all the music. It's really amazing.
It took him many years to get this project done. He had to source the material from a lot of different places. He's going to talk about that. In the end, it ends up being 38 CDs with 432 tracks on
Whoa!
It. It's I believe he describes it as about 36 hours of music total.
Yep.
And there's a lot of other stuff in this set you can buy as well. There's a Blu-ray of the Woodstock film. There's a hardbound book. There's all sorts of things. But the music is what really sets this apart from previous sets that were released.
Yeah.
There's some shorter sets you can get to. There's, I mean, by shorter, 10 CD, 5 LP, a 3 CD. There's a lot of stuff. But we talked to him about this massive collection that is going on sale. It is called Woodstock Back to the Garden, the definitive 50th anniversary archive. And this is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And let's get to this conversation with Andy Zaks. Andy Zaks, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, this is an enormous undertaking.
Yes.
What is it? 38 discs, right?
38 music. 38 CDs. It runs about 36 hours, just maybe a minute or two under 36 hours, incredibly enough.
And you started working on it 15 years ago, roughly?
Yeah. I mean, but I should say that doesn't mean I worked on it consistently for 14 years. That would be, I mean, this is a crazy undertaking, but I'm not that crazy. But Yeah, we did. We did originally begin working on it at the end of 2005. That was our first day in the studio mixing stuff. And we were working at that time toward the 40th anniversary in 2009. And there was a box set that came out then that was six discs. So a much smaller fraction of the total at that point. And that was about as good as we could do in 2009. Anyway, at a certain point, a few years went by, and the nagging thing in the back of my head that felt somehow unfulfilled because I hadn't quite gotten to the whole thing or hadn't quite been able to persuade somebody to let me deal with the whole thing, kept nudging me. So I went to my friend at Rhino, Steve Woolard, and said, you may not want to think about this again, but we should really think about this. The 50th is coming. And he grudgingly agreed. And we began talking through exactly what it was that we'd need to do this thing. And then we did it.
How do you even approach a project of this magnitude?
First, you get really intimidated. Then you realize that the only way this is going to work is if you break it down into very, very small components.
Right.
And then you work on the small components. And then eventually the small components add up into bigger components. And eventually this thing emerges. That's a whole lot easier sounding when I said it out loud just now than it actually was in real life. In actual real life, it was it was horrible, but great at the same time, but horrible. I should emphasize that it was really, but many parts of this were just, you know, it's like solving one of the hardest jigsaw puzzles ever created with no map and no idea how the pieces fit together, and all the pieces are the same size.
What did you have to work with exactly? I mean, people know, music fans know that Woodstock was recorded. I mean, there was an album released, the following year. There was the film. I mean, people know that these sound recordings existed, but what did you discover and sort of what was the quality of the work,
sure,
the tapes you had?
Well, there were a lot of tapes. I inherited a ton of tapes, not just the original tapes, but also the tapes that were sort of produced by other people working on it over the years, which tended mostly to confuse the issue and bulk everything up. So there's a lot of absolute original tape that went through the machines that actually were on Maxie Asker's farm, and those are both in, there are multi-tracks, and there are also mono reels that just went through, there was a mono tape machine running off the soundboard. So those are the two types of original recordings that are there. And the confusing part is that a lot of these things aren't marked well, so you don't quite know. Sometimes you have to compare reels just to figure out, kind of from the level of tape hiss, what's real and what's a copy. So there are copies, there are submasters, there are duplicates, there are dubs, there are edited reels, there are partial reels, there are mixdowns, there are multi-track reels that contain lots of overdubs. You name it, it exists. And so there's a lot of chaff that you have to discard before you get to the wheat, if that makes any sense. So what I looked at when I was looking at all of this stuff for the first time was all of the Woodstock tape and then all of this other stuff, most of which is more extraneous, but all of which had to be kind of looked at and thought about and evaluated at some point, which slowly but surely we did.
Andy, I got to ask you a question.
Yeah.
The question that came to my mind when I first started thinking about this is, what constitutes an original tape? Like you talked, like what is the pure source and what, you know, is not? And I know you had to patch stuff in, but what was their original plan, I guess, to record it? And how was that executed?
Yeah. I mean, the original plan was they knew that they were going to do something with this stuff. There were a couple of different film crews. It was a bit of a confusing situation, but they knew that there was going to be a film, and they knew that they would probably try to monetize it with some sort of a record as well.
Okay.
I think they were, you know, it's part of the original impetus for Woodstock was that these guys wanted to build a big recording studio in Woodstock, New York.
Oh.
That's why the festival is basically known as Woodstock, although it became obvious really quickly that it wasn't going to take place there, nor did it take place in Wallkill, which
right.
was the secondary location, which they got kicked out of 3.5 weeks before the actual event happened. So
sounds familiar.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, no, I mean, nothing like that could ever happen again, right? So the real, actual, honest-to-God original tapes are the multi-track tapes, which are two A-track machines that were running staggered.
Okay.
And you ran them staggered because if you started one machine and then you started the second machine 10 or 15 minutes later, if some band played a very long song, you stood a much better chance of capturing the whole thing on one tape so that you wouldn't have to chop it all up.
Change reels, yeah.
Right. That sometimes worked and mostly did not. And people chopped the reels up anyway, yeah. And that's what added to the pain. But yeah, so those are real. And then just the simple mono board tapes that somebody, thank God, decided to make. Or in fact, it's odd because on the first day they seem to have been running those in similar fashion to the way they ran the staggered eight-track machines. So there's multiple reels from the first day, and on the second day they clearly got tired or bored or thought, well, this isn't going to be necessary, so they only ran one tape. And,
okay.
And that, as it turned out, that was a bad decision. if I could go back in time and stop them from doing that, I would be persuasive about preventing them from doing that. But those are the actual original absolute materials. There's a couple of other things that were recorded by documentary crews as what they call wild sound,
mm-hmm.
where somebody goes out wandering around with a Nagra recorder and talks to people in the audience.
Right.
There's a couple of bits of audio that showed up later that stem from reels like that.
Okay.
And it does appear that the film crew, at least early on, maybe was recording a bit of audio of their own, because that's where some of the earliest stage announcements predate reel one of the actual sort of professionally recorded audio.
Mm-hmm.
We do have maybe 10, 12 minutes of stuff
that
precedes that the first proper honest to God reel.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those eight-track tapes and those board tapes.
Okay.
That's 99% of it is right there.
Okay.
Are you amazed though that this stuff even existed? Because I mean, the stories of Woodstock are, you know, a certain amount of organizational chaos that took place, and you're talking now 50 years later. To be able to even have the quality of recordings that exist for the entire run of the show is really kind of amazing when you think about it.
Yeah, no, it's completely amazing. You're right. The event was total chaos, so it's remarkable that we got as much as we got and that we have as much to work with as we really do.
Mm-hmm.
That said, the chaos does extend to the tapes as well. You know, I probably could have saved a year or two of work on these things if the people who had been working on the movie, Michael Wadley's documentary in 1970, had maybe stopped to think for a minute, you know, maybe somebody might want to play around with this stuff in the future. Maybe this might have some utility in a couple of decades. Maybe we shouldn't be so cavalier when we're chopping this up.
Right.
Maybe I shouldn't have just thrown away that reel of announcements that I thought were garbage and just kind of shoved away after I took out the 90 seconds of it I decided I wanted to use.
Right.
You know, if people had been a little more proactive or a little more thoughtful and considerate of me, you know, they were not taking into account my needs and those of my intrepid mixing engineer, Brian Kehew. We would have been a lot happier, and we would have gotten a lot more sleep if the fossil record had been truly complete. But it wasn't complete almost from minute one. People stole master tapes from Woodstock before the show was even over.
Wow.
So, you know, you deal with what you've got to deal with. And so even though the primary materials mostly exist, there are other places where we've had to sort of fill in from secondary sources, where somebody copied something off before the original tape vanished forever. Or, you know, there's some mysterious source that came from some other place that replaces something that just simply isn't on the shelf. There are one or two bits that are patched in from, there's an immense fan community devoted to trying to, they've been working for years to try to put together a big compendium of Woodstock audio. And a lot of that stuff is, I admire them for their unbelievable tenacity and their, frankly, their incredible willingness to listen to audio that is so substandard and so kind of just so poor.
Yeah.
And that's not a judgment call. That's just a fact.
Right.
You know, they have collated things like some guy who brought a battery-operated tape recorder to the festival and turned it on periodically for 20 or 30 seconds at a time, and the batteries are dying. And so what you hear is just this messy, smeary kind of
noise. I buried Paul. Yeah.
it's remarkable that they've been able to kind of figure out what some of that stuff is. I wouldn't have had the patience. So that kind of stuff wasn't usable, but they did inherit at various points certain things that had clearly been taken some point in the decades from audio sources that were much, much closer to the real thing, that were some kind of professional sources that have been copied and copied and copied even after the originals had disappeared. So I probably borrowed maybe... there might be 60 to 90 seconds of stuff I grabbed from them with tremendous gratitude. But those are the kind of lanes that you have to go to with this stuff. You have to think way, way outside the box.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. Today, you know, you have festival goers who are taping everything on their phones, right? And these actually are pretty good microphones. Yeah. Like, you could now piece together a whole show based on, like, fan footage and things. Yeah.
You know, if only. If somebody had smuggled a cell phone back through time to
That's
Woodstock,
right.
Yeah, again, I would have been in much, much better shape, assuming they'd had enough of a battery charger to last for 3.5 days.
Right, yeah.
Yes.
Tell us about the first song curse.
Oh, the first song curse. Sure. Well, think about it this way. So normally, under normal circumstances, if you or I were audio professionals in 2019 and somebody asked us to go record a bunch of bands playing in a field someplace, and we had relatively rudimentary equipment, I mean, everything at Woodstock was kind of state-of-the-art for the time, but that doesn't make it any less rudimentary from a 50 years later standpoint. So normally, what you would do in that kind of a situation where you knew you were going to have a lot of different people blowing through the stage and you didn't maybe want to take the time to reset everything in between bands, you would generally determine, okay, we have 8 tracks here and we know that 1 track is always going to be an audience mic and we know that 1 track is going to be a 60-cycle tone that the film people who are filming this are going to use to sync up the rushes to the music with. So that gives us 6 actual tracks of audio, which really isn't very much at all. Mm-mm. So under those circumstances, you can kind of assume that there's going to be a vocalist. So then you might say, okay, audience mic is always going to be 1. Vocal mic is always going to be 2. So we're always going to put that there. And then so on. You could assign, you could kind of go, well, okay, guitar, lead guitar, 3. Drums, 6 and 7, or maybe just 7, depending on how many things you've got. You know, you'd have a relatively stable track lineup. And that is not how they did it at Woodstock. Not at all. So I don't know why. It's hard to explain. No one's ever been able to give me a good explanation for what the point of this was. But they would kind of wipe the slate clean after every band played, which meant that at the beginning of the next set, they were constantly patching and repatching and patching some more to try to get everything onto the tapes. And sometimes they would forget to do fairly basic things like put people's vocal mics up. So, you know, you'll have a song. Famously, Arlo Guthrie's Coming into Los Angeles, which is heard on the Woodstock soundtrack, but not from Woodstock. It's from the Troubadour in L.A. several months later because somebody forgot to put the volume up on his vocal mic for the first 90 seconds of the song. So, you know, you have problems like that, or the bass will migrate randomly in the middle of the song from track 2 to track 5. or maybe the bass will just drop out and disappear for 30 or 40 seconds, and you'll wonder what happened, and then it magically reappears somewhere else on the tape. So it can be unbelievably confounding, and generally speaking, when you mix Woodstock from the multitracks, it will usually take you as long to mix the first song for that reason, because that's where everything is blowing up and chaotic. Then they tended to leave it alone, mostly. Not always, but enough of the time. So usually mixing the rest of the set will take less time than mixing the first song. So that's kind of the first song curse. That's where horrible stuff happens on the audio. That's where a lot of the stuff that has made us over the years just sit there in the studio throwing up our hands going, what the hell did they do? Yeah. Why did they do? Oh, seriously? No way. Oh. So, yeah, those first songs can be tough. They will break your heart nearly every time. And that's the curse.
That's fascinating. It really is. It must have been really like a mystery, you know, a puzzle that you're kind of putting back together years and years later.
Yeah, blindfolded, with one hand tied behind your back, and after someone spun you around in circles for 35 seconds just to make sure that you've got a preemptive case of vertigo before you begin. Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. Easy enough, right?
Yeah.
So I've messed around in bands, you know, kind of my whole life. And I had a friend who I played with once who really had this idea that we should record a song that starts on a Friday night, like when we get together, and ends like on a Sunday evening. So I'm so fascinated that you called this a large scale durational experience. Do you think, Andy, that putting it out in a truncated version and a shorter version somehow dilutes what you've kind of achieved? Like in, you know, I guess there's going to be a relatively tiny 10 CD box or something like that. I mean, how do you feel about that as like you have to do it all immersively from Friday to Sunday?
Yeah. I mean, different things with different objectives.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, right. You wouldn't necessarily think that a 10 disc set that's 13 hours long would feel small,
right,
by any stretch of the imagination.
Cheated.
And yet,
that's right.
and yet it does in comparison to this big thing. But those kind of packages, at least I hope anyway, those I put them together because I put all of those together as well. Made for different purposes and different audiences, and they do form different sorts of listening experiences. Mm-hmm. There's a good amount of the flavor of the experience on that 10 disc that did give me enough sprawling room that I think anybody casual who dips into that will at least be able to get some idea of what the larger 36 hour piece is like.
Right.
But the full, real, no kidding, uncut experience is there on the 36 hour thing. And it really is, yeah, in a sense, it is a very, very long sound installation piece.
Yeah.
I never really thought of it as, okay, here we have 32 live performances and some connective tissue. I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
I think of it as this is a kind of a living, breathing unit of time and space, and it happens to feature 32 musical performances and some talking and some noise and some environmental sounds and
yeah,
weather, you name it. It's got, you know, all of life is kind of lurking,
yeah,
somewhere in there. And that's what I think is kind of interesting. And it interests me just as somebody who is sort of interested in time. You know, I mean, I'm interested in sound and I'm interested in music, but I'm interested in the way both of those things work with time. And that really, to me, is kind of at the forefront of the big box. It's a time experience. It really is kind of about adjusting yourself to the pace of this thing and the way it flows. And I think that there is something that you get when you're hearing it that way that isn't quite the same, even on a really generous package like the 10 disc
right,
thing,
right,
it isn't quite the same.
Right.
So but I also don't assume that everybody wants or needs to hear it that way.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you might just want to hear Soul Sacrifice, and I don't judge.
Right.
That's perfectly fine.
Well, I think all the four of us who had that band are going to go in on the set together, and we'll sort of share it maybe and sit down and listen to it all together. It'd be great.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah.
But you did make an interesting decision here to separate the bands by disc.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
right,
not just one rolling experience. You can just go in and pick one particular performance you want to listen to.
Sure. If you want to hear it that way, you definitely can hear it that way. And again, I don't assume that people who have the big box are necessarily going to want to hear 7 hours of it at a shot. That would be a little right, presumptuous on my part. So if you just want to go and hear The Who, I have no problem with that at all. If you just want to go in and hear Arlo Guthrie, then that's fine. I hope you love it. But if you do want to hear it all added together, then yes. I mean, in some sense, it wouldn't have been possible because the rights for these things don't really govern doing something like this. But I wouldn't have minded just kind of shoving it on a big memory stick or something like that, so that you really could just put it on
wild, yeah,
and let the thing unfold.
Right.
As it is, I'm reasonably certain that people will rip the CDs onto various devices and be able to play it back
right,
in that way. So you can very easily create that scenario with, yeah. with minimal effort on your part once you got it in hand.
That's
so
So that's part one
yep.
of the
Just
interview. We cut this into three parts.
Yep.
We cut it in such a way that future historians will not be able to restore it in any sort of way, right?
We do that on purpose.
Yes, right.
You know, it really is. Rock in the Suburbs is not, you know, necessarily a time capsule. We're of the moment, folks.
Right.
You listen to us every day. So we're here with you in your daily rhythms. We're not preserving for future generations here.
But what a great conversation. And it's so great
cool.
that we want to keep it going. So he talked a lot about the actual work that went into putting this set together
yeah.
in this portion of the interview. But tomorrow we're going to get into some more fun stuff, like maybe like who we thought should have played at Woodstock.
Such
who
a great answer.
Stuff like that. I mean, this guy really is a definitive expert on the music of Woodstock because he's lived it for the last several years.
Yeah. Yeah, totally has.
If you are new to our show, if you came just to listen to this Woodstock
episode. If you're here for the Woodstock.
What you want to do is just keep listening to the next episode and the one after that to
yeah.
keep it going. So whatever podcast platform you're listening to now,
uh-huh.
just go in and listen to the next episodes or hit the subscribe button and
That's
then
right.
the episodes just come right to you. Or if all of that confuses you, just go to suburbspod.com and you'll see all the episodes there and you can just listen to them. On that platform,
that's
right?
A great,
so any of those things.
That's a great way to do it if you just have your computer around during the day, you know, or you can even ask your Alexa to play Rockin' the Suburbs podcast and it'll work.
That'll
so,
work.
Yeah, it will. It
Say
works
Say the
now.
Word podcast
yep.
and that'll do that.
Yep. Just make sure to add podcast in the end and it'll do it for you. Google Home works the
yep.
same way.
So we hope that you will continue to listen. And also, if anybody wants to converse with us about Woodstock or other matters of rock and roll, you can email us, rock@suburbspod.com, or you can leave a message on our phone line and we'll put your voice on an upcoming episode. That number is 612-440-1984. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, all of those at Suburbs Pod. All right, let's move on to tomorrow. More of the interview with record producer Andy Zaks. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow. It's 3 days of peace and
love.
Music and Andy Zaks, right?